I'm going to stand over here so I don't have to turn around the whole time. Thank you all for coming so late in the conference, and I hope I can get through all my material in the next 20 minutes. I'd like to start with, I may not be able to, let's give this a try. I'm going to have to stand over here after all. People ordinarily begin by giving an outline, but I want to begin actually with what people usually do at the end of their talk, which is acknowledgments, because these two people that I worked with first during my graduate program and then after it give the questions that I'll be talking about today. Lee Van Valen was an evolutionary biologist who died in 2010, who served on my dissertation committee and then worked with me for about 10 years after that on a very interesting question. Richard Buggs is a geneticist at the University of London with whom I've been collaborating on another question. My question with Lee was, if the theory of common descent were false, how would we know it? And my question with Richard was, what is the role of so-called orphan genes in biology and evolution? Now, these two questions turned out to be intimately related. Let me first give you a formulation of common descent from a textbook I used as an undergraduate, just to reacquaint you with the idea, and that is that all life on Earth is descended from a common ancestor that lived in the remote past. So you saw this tree yesterday if you were in this session. Stephen Freeland presented it. This is the universal tree of life due to the work of Carl Woese and collaborators. We are on the branch here, the animals. Pretty much everything you see on Animal Planet is restricted just to this part of the universal tree of life. So most of the genetic diversity of life is actually found elsewhere. Now, what you need to keep in mind is this domain, the scope of this theory, is universal. Every living thing on this planet for which we have any evidence, whether it's fossil evidence or evidence genetic from an extant group, falls within the domain of common descent. So it is the most general theory in biology, and for that feature alone, very attractive to many biologists. Now, as a PhD student in the mid-90s, I found that most biologists were very wary of raising questions about the theory. So we have the safe topics in biology. Those are the ones right in the middle of the table, if you think of that as a sort of crystal ball. Then you have the risky topics that are closer to the edge. You can still do research on them, maybe even get funding, but they're a little more problematic. Questioning common descent was down here. It was not something that well-educated biologists would do. That situation has changed very dramatically from the mid-90s until today. Some of you may be familiar with this cover story from a couple of years ago in New Scientist. Darwin was wrong, uprooting Darwin's tree. Now, the writer of the piece, Graham Lawton, came under a lot of criticism for having drafted it, but he was merely reporting on developments that had already occurred within evolutionary theory over the preceding decade. And I give you one example here from the PNAS 2002. Carl Woese, the scientist responsible for that three-domain picture, had come to reject the theory of universal common ancestry. And in fact, this view now within evolutionary theory is increasingly widespread. So if you go to this online journal, which is entirely open access, edited by Eugene Koonin at the NCBI, Laura Landweber at Princeton, and David Littman, also at the NCBI, they are running a series called Beyond the Tree of Life, where biologists attempt to describe geometries that differ from that universal tree that I showed you a moment ago. Nevertheless, for most biologists, universal common ancestry is still the case. In other words, there is a singularity in the history of life to which all living things on this planet trace their ancestry. And that picture, by the way, is not a proper phylogenetic diagram. It's just a cartoon meant to suggest this historical singularity. Now, the question I asked in my dissertation in Chicago was this: if this theory were not true, how would we know it? Now, you might think that a universally quantified theory ought to be easy to challenge with observation. In fact, it turns out to be very difficult to answer this question. But you need to be able to answer it unless you're going to hold the theory as an axiom, which would not be a sensible thing to do. Darwin himself suggested a test. This is about midway into The Origin of Species, and he said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ, and we can generalize that to any biological system, could not have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Now, ordinarily, this is taken to be a test relating to the mechanism of natural selection. In fact, Darwin intended it to be applied to common ancestry as well. And don't be distracted by those adjectives. It doesn't have to be successive and slight modifications. They just have to be viable modifications, whatever the grain or size of the interval happens to be. So we can focus on just one of those pathways, this one, A to B. Now, you'll notice that B lies within the domain of common descent, but it might not. B prime could lie outside. And the logic of the test holds that if there are biological objects that fall outside the domain, we would know that it was not universal and therefore the theory would be false. Now, there's a logical problem, however. That's what I said just a moment ago. Oh, by the way, this test has come to have a name in evolutionary theory, and it's very widespread. It's called the principle of continuity. And it's simplicity itself. If you posit a transformation from A to B, that's the evolutionary pathway by which B came to be, then every point on that pathway must be biologically possible. Now, that may seem like a truism. In fact, it's an incredibly powerful test for any evolutionary hypothesis. But there's a logical difficulty. We have a universally quantified theory. In other words, every living thing for which we have any evidence falls within the domain, so how could there be anything outside it? Now, Darwin himself and evolutionary biologists since his time have solved that logical problem by using something called counterfactual conditionals, where the assertion before the comma, that is the counterfactual aspect of the test, is something that is actually not the case but might have been or might be. So we say, if it were the case that fill in some observation, then we would know that common descent is false. And this turns out to give the theory apparent empirical content because you can locate points out here in counterfactual space like unique genes and proteins, variant genetic codes, out-of-order fossils, incongruent phylogenies, and so forth. Locate those points out there, outside that domain, and say, if we saw X, Y, or Z, then we would have reason to believe that the theory was not universal and therefore false. Now, what happens in practice is quite interesting. Many of these points located in counterfactual space are actually observed to be the case. And I'll focus on just one, unique genes and proteins. And by unique, I mean phylogenetically isolated. Of course, at the time that Darwin formulated this test, nothing was known about genetics at all, but science moves forward. And now we have a tremendous amount of data that has accumulated that Darwin, of course, could not have anticipated, but that modern molecular biologists know. Now, this is a striking figure because I was a graduate student in this period, and with respect to what we knew about the genetics of life, it was basically nothing. This figure only shows the curve of accumulated genomic data to 2008. I would really need to revise it to show it up to 2012. This curve has really gone out of sight. And I want to focus on one puzzle that's arisen in this curve of discovery called orphan genes. Now, there's a pun in the title or in the name orphan. An orphan, molecular biology, as many of you probably know, stands for an open reading frame. It's a sequence of DNA that codes for protein. And it has characteristic molecular features that, in fact, you can train an algorithm to detect, such as start sites, a long open reading frame with no stop codons, unless they're specially translated, and then a stop, where that reading frame is long enough actually to code for a polypeptide. And you can, as I said, train an algorithm to look for those features to tell you that you have a candidate gene, or what's very likely a candidate gene. Now, known sequences, those stored in GenBank, are annotated with respect to their function. When you deposit genetic information in GenBank that's been sequenced and annotated, the functions, the associated functions, are part of that deposition. So in the box on the bottom, we have four sample sequences already in GenBank, and our sequence on the top has been newly determined, and we find, using BLAST or some other algorithm that Deb just described, a match. That's a ribosomal protein. That tells us what this sequence is probably doing. Now, when the whole genome enterprise got underway, it was noticed right from the start that there were many apparent genes in genomes that had no associated functions, which was curious. Russell Doolittle at UCSD, in a survey in 2002, looking at just a handful of genomes at the time, described it as the greatest surprise from whole genome data, at least at that point. In every genome examined so far, he writes, at least a quarter of the genes remain hypothetical and that no function can be ascribed. So he's looking at just a small slice of data available right about here. Of course, the signal is now very much stronger. And Doolittle in the survey went on to say, how could there be so much in the way of unknown equipment? Where these unique sequences are coming from and what they do remain baffling mysteries. Now, I need to make a very important distinction that I failed to do once in a talk on this topic and paid for on the web. Orphans, by definition, fall within the class of genes of unknown function, but not all genes of unknown function are orphans. Many genes of unknown function have homologs in other taxa. So you'll see that in this Venn diagram, orphans are a subset within genes of unknown function. I wanted to make that crystal clear. So here's our orphans puzzle. We submit our genomic data, the box on the white, all the genes, or all the DNA, excuse me, from some species we've sequenced to GenBank. We get back matches, let's say, for 80%. Orphans, no matches. Hence the pun in their name. These are orphan sequences that probably have a function but have no clear evolutionary ancestry. Now, this puzzle was noticed immediately by investigators who were working in bioinformatics. So this Israeli team, writing in 2003, the very next year after Doolittle, called these sequences mysteries awaiting interpretation. They wrote, if evolution works through descent with modification, why do we find no similar sequences today in other organisms? Where are the necessary intermediates that must have given rise to these orphans? I'll come back to that question. But there's something else about whole genome data that's really quite wonderful, and that is it allows you to do experiments like global transposon mutagenesis. If you have the complete sequence of, let's say, a bacterial species, and this sort of experiment has been done many times now, you can introduce a transposon, a sequence which integrates itself randomly into other DNA, and notice where those transposons land. In this case, you've hit at least one essential gene and the cells die. You can't grow them. You can't plate them. They're dead. Same here. Sometimes, however, transposons will integrate and yet you'll be able to grow the cells because the transposons land in positions on that chromosome in genes that were not essential for growth under laboratory conditions. Well, you can see that starting from that population on the right, you can work your way backwards, map the DNA, look where the transposons have landed, and the very fact that you see them in living cells tells you the gene that we've hit with this transposon probably is not essential. Now, as I said, that experiment has been done several times, most recently by a group at Stanford using Colobacter, a bacteria found in fresh water. And what they found was quite remarkable. The last sentence there of the passage I've excerpted, 1,012 essential genome features, 480 open reading frames, 402 regulatory sequences, 130 non-coding elements, including 90 segments of unknown function. Now, Lucy Shapiro, the senior author on the project, in a news story, described it this way. She said there were many surprises. For instance, we found 91. I think there's a typo there in the news story, but I didn't wasn't able to clarify why it was 90 in the abstract and 91 in this news story. In any case, it's in that ballpark. We have no idea what these sequences do. These may provide clues to unknown bacterial functions. Now, here's the take-home message for evolution. Here's a Venn diagram from their paper where they compare the essential genes of Colobacter to the essential genes of E. coli. And you'll notice that there are significant percentages of essential hardware in these two species, both within the proteobacteria, that are unique to those two species. What this suggests is that the fundamental molecular hardware in those two species is not entirely congruent. In fact, there's significant regions in their genomes of essential hardware that is not shared with a relative. So here's a very simple analogy. You go to an auto show, pop the hood on several vehicles and look at their engines, and you find that some parts are shared, but there are other parts that are unique depending on the car that you're looking at. That would be very unusual engineering. The essential parts of these engines are not the same. Now, what's striking about many orphans is when you look at their functional role found in single species, you find that the functional role is not peripheral, but in fact central to the biochemistry of that particular group. So, for instance, in an archaean, a single-cell species from the domain Archaea that is a heat-loving organism, its topoisomerase, which is a DNA disentangling protein, is unique and found only in that species. In fact, the author who wrote this paper studies topoisomerases, and in the paper he says, how mean of Mother Nature to give this wonderful enzyme only to a single species. What's remarkable about this topoisomerase is it's stable under high temperature and is very useful in a lab kit. In fact, that's how it's employed in labs around the world. Now, motivated by this puzzle, this author went and looked at the distribution of topoisomerases throughout all of life. And what he found was quite remarkable. He said, based on evolutionary expectations, we would expect, starting from the last universal common ancestor, one topo 1, which is the topoisomerase that makes single-stranded cuts, and one topo 2, which cuts both strands of the DNA. And then he has this little joke here. An intelligent designer would have invented only one topo 1 and only one topo 2 to make life easy for biochemists. The reality, he goes on, turned out to be quite different and more interesting. As is the case with other enzymes working with DNA, such as DNA polymerases, the distribution of topoisomerases is not congruent with the universal tree of life based on 16S ribosomal RNA. This is the picture that he generated from his data. Now, you can kind of see the three domains underneath all that spaghetti. Eukarya at the top, archaea on the right, and bacteria on the bottom. But most of these topoisomerases are coming from ancient viral reservoirs, which I have to tell you, I have a great deal of respect for this author. These are deus ex machina postulates to explain the appearance of enzymes without evolutionary precursors. So you can always blame it on viruses and have it come from a virus and be integrated into the genomes of modern organisms. But there's no phylogenetic logic here really at all. I think in a sense this is a reductio ad absurdum of the three domains picture. This pattern of orphans and their abundance is not going away. A few years ago, I gave a talk at Dartmouth on this topic based on the data that were available at the time. And there was a microbiologist sitting right in the front row. And when I came to the Q&A, he was one of the first people to raise his hand. And he said, Paul, I had showed a slide for a sample of 122 whole genomes. He said, put that number in the denominator position. Now, what's in the numerator? Oh, excuse me. I can never remember which one is which. Which one goes on top? It's the numerator. All right. What's in the denominator position in terms of prokaryotes? Millions. Millions of species. He says that's a terrible sample. You're generalizing on the basis of a tiny sample of a very large sphere of objects. You're bound to be wrong. Well, I had to admit, yeah, it wasn't the most robust data set. Nevertheless, I thought the trend was clear. Well, subsequent research, I'm happy to say, has supported my position. For instance, this paper which I think is now open access, describes a very interesting experiment done by two people at the University of Connecticut interested in this question. What they did is they sampled 573 bacterial genomes randomly, pulling genes out one at a time and asking the other 572 species who else has this gene in their genome. Now, this figure from their paper is a little confusing, but it describes their results. There are two ways of representing it. There's a pie chart here, which shows an average bacterial genome. This little slice here, the 8%, those are the genes that this species would share with any other bacterial species. They're mostly ribosomal proteins and central metabolism, kind of basic housekeeping proteins. This bigger slice here, 64%, are what they call character genes, which are relevant to life in some particular environmental niche. The 28% here, this green slice, those are the genes found just in that species. Now, if you think about the way you're going to count these, the unique fraction is going to grow in total numbers much more rapidly than the other two because these are unique words, and you count them once and you don't find them elsewhere, so that green ball, which is the other way of representing the data, is going to get bigger much faster than these other two, which is, in fact, what genomics over the past 15 years has found. So what they did is they took their data and fitted it to an exponential decay function, and they argued that the size of the bacterial domain in terms of its genomes is of infinite extent, infinite size. Now, that's hyperbole. There are a lot of bacteria on this planet, but they're not infinite in number, so it really should be indefinitely large. But the point is, their argument was, every time you sequence a new bacterial species, you will see genes that you've never seen before. In fact, within particular groups like E. coli, every strain that's sequenced of E. coli reveals genes that have never been seen before. The problem for common ancestry works out... It arises from the fact that the orphans are going to accumulate much more rapidly than the shared sequences. That's what we see in this figure here. But if they came from a common ancestor, you went into a problem. So here's a little phylogenetic tree. I don't think Dennis is here. That's why, we're contemporaneous, so I put him in there. But what's going to happen to the genome of Luca if we have to put not just the shared sequences, but the orphans in there as well, or the progenitors, the ancestors of the orphans? I love PowerPoint. The size of the genome of Luca, and in fact, the size of the genomes at the nodes, the major branching nodes, right through the tree of life, are going to grow rapidly beyond what is biologically plausible. And Ford Doolittle at Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia, who studies this problem, has called it the genome of Eden problem. That the gene numbers at the branching nodes for major groups along the tree of life rapidly grow beyond anything that's biologically plausible. Now, one attempt has been made to solve this problem by horizontal transfer, but really it just moves the problem somewhere else. And even if you move the novel sequences off to viral sources, you really haven't solved the problem. I don't have time to go into all the details today, but I encourage you to look into this problem because it won't go away. Every new genome that comes in adds orphans for which we need ancestors. So in light of these data and other such puzzles, people like Eugene Koonin have said the tree of life did not exist. This paper, by the way, is open access, and I encourage you to download it because Biology Direct, where Koonin is actually an editor, adds the referee reports to the back of the paper, and you can watch the debate back and forth between the author and his referees, and it's a very healthy way of doing science. In fact, it's one of my favorite journals for that very reason. Craig Venter, who doesn't need any introduction here, in 2007... surveying these patterns, said, I just don't buy that there was ever Luca or a tree of life. He said there must have been thousands of common ancestors, and they weren't so common, meaning that there wasn't a great deal of overlap in their genomes. We're now 5 years from the point at which he made this remark, and I think he would reinforce it today in light of the discovery of the very high numbers of orphan sequences in the whole genomes that we have now. I should tell you a little anecdote before I conclude that actually it was 5 years ago. I was at a small meeting in Chicago with Francis Collins and gave a summary of this problem at the time. And Collins just held up his hands and he said, "Paul, it's just not that significant." He said, "These orphans are found in viruses and prokaryotes. We don't find them in animals. We don't really find them elsewhere in the tree of life. They're just not that interesting, unless you're a microbiologist." And at the time, there were not a lot of animal genomes available. But I, again, would like to report that the frequency of orphans in animal genomes, in some cases, is really astonishingly high. Since I have a little time, let me show you one example of this. In 2010, 2011, 6 ant genomes were sequenced in their entirety. These were the first ants to have this survey done. And the percentages were quite striking. So in the fire ant, 18% of its genes were orphans. In the Florida carpenter and Jordan's jumping ant, the numbers were 18% and 14% respectively. But look at these next three: invasive Argentine, red harvester, and leaf cutter. 45%, 49%, over half. Now, to my knowledge, these 6 genomes have not been blasted against each other. So those numbers will probably come down once those genomes are compared to each other. But if you look at ant phylogeny, 14,000 species approximately worldwide, how likely is it that we just happen to pick the 6 ant genomes in the world that have these anomalously high orphan percentages? And if you run the numbers, which I did just as a kind of thought experiment, that orphan's percentage is too high because these genomes have not been compared, so let's knock it in half just to be safe. Just within this subfamily, about 5,800 species, you're talking a tremendous amount of unique genetic information. And if you extrapolate that out to 14,000 ant species, you've got a universe of genetic information to account for. Anyway, I should stop and take questions.
Hi, Paul.
Hi.
There is no universal common ancestor. Get over it. You know, even in the latest edition of Campbell, it's gone. There's a book. There's this mishmash at the beginning, and that bush or that whatever you want to call it, it has different names nowadays. But that's the new universal common ancestor.
Can I respond to that? Let's take them seriatim. Fine, get rid of it. But now you have a problem. The signal for homology is sequence similarity, right? That's how BLAST works. If you eliminate the last universal common ancestor, all the features putatively present in that entity now cease to give you history. So the ribosome, the basic metabolic cycles, the polymerases, all that basic hardware may have arisen polyphyletically from multiple independent starting points. If you do that, if you cut the link between molecular similarity and homology, it's impossible to stop the consequences as you go up into the tree of life. So you can get rid of the last universal common ancestor, but the tree starts to fracture from the bottom up.
Suggests to me that new gene production is easy.
And that's where most investigators are going right now. In fact, there was just a paper in Nature this past week on de novo gene origin in yeast. And what the authors argued is that there appears to be transcription of sequences that are not open reading frames, but they're close enough to being open reading frames that with a little tinkering they might turn into genuine genes. I'm willing to consider that. The problem is, if that's a polypeptide product, it's got to find a role in the biochemistry of that cell, and the last thing you want to do is churn out a bunch of proteins without jobs to do.
Well, maybe that's a little story of origin of life.
But I'm agreeing with you that the way to go to solve this problem, this is what Van Valen said to me when we used to talk about it. He said, we need a theory for the origin of genes in which they don't leave ancestry. They appear overnight, de novo. We need some theory for the very rapid origin of new open reading frames. And he said, we don't have such a theory now, but people are heading in that direction.
And then finally, you mentioned it, that the lateral transfer.
It's like the problem with lateral transfer, it's like robbing Peter to pay Paul. Every gene in a virus has to go through a cell, and they don't. The viral reservoir does not originate in viruses. I didn't have time. Yeah, well, listen, I didn't have time to talk about it in this presentation, but orphans percentages in viruses are up 60-70%. It blows your mind. So you've got this huge reservoir in the oceans, let's say, of unique sequences that I think we really need to start thinking about. The problem is lateral transfer won't solve the problem because you just end up moving it somewhere else and you've still got to explain the origin of those sequences. Maybe we should move on to
That's my vision next. Please feel free to speak afterwards. Any other questions before we
move on? Well, I was thinking about exactly what Terry said, if that's a good way of explaining this data. And I have an idea, and I'd like to just run by you and see if this is an implication of that idea that if genes can originate very rapidly, you can explain this data essentially. Then I thought if descent with modification was true, you would still see lots of shared genes among species because every species that speciates, even if itself had lots of unique genes that maybe originated very rapidly, they would then pass those unique genes on to their daughter species. And if we sequence those daughter species, we'd then learn that their genes are not orphaned, so you would not see this pattern. So the only way that I can reconcile common descent with the data you presented is that yes, all organisms share a common ancestor, and yes, genes can originate very rapidly, but this rapid origination of genes has only happened since the last speciation event in each species history, and otherwise they would have evolved untold numbers of these genes.
Yeah, I see Anne back there shaking her head. I don't think the problem will go away, even if you have a rapid mechanism, because you've got to have a template at some point, even if you're templating out of junk or non-coding sequences. And presumably, that original template will show up on a blast search somewhere. You can't just pull these out of the air. You've got to have a source for them. And it's interesting, in the work that I've been doing with Richard Buggs, we've looked at several orphans that actually have experimental data where they were assayed for function. And it turns out they're remarkably important in every case where they've been examined. So in Hydra, freshwater polyp, orphans in Hydra give the species its anatomy that couldn't be more basic for an animal. Even in viruses, where they look to be not doing anything, where they've been examined, they turn out to have functional roles. So I'm sorry, I've achieved some notoriety on the web for being a cheerleader for orphans, but I feel like biology has turned on its 100-inch reflector. You know, when Mount Wilson became active as an instrument in the first two decades of the 20th century, the dimensions of the physical universe went from about 300,000 light years to many orders of magnitude greater than that. You know, what looked to Harlow Shapley to be a nebula turned out to be Andromeda. Those were stars. That was a whole other island universe. And I think that biology now, with rapid and inexpensive DNA sequencing has finally turned on its 100-inch reflector, and there's no way to that these data cannot end up changing our theories in a dramatic way.
Okay, so we have a couple more questions, but we are past the 30-minute time frame. If you would like to start hanging out if you'd like, we have dinner next, but if you'd like to sit down for the next couple questions, we'll feel free. Okay, so I'm going to start over here.
I admit this question is from left field, but
look like her center field to me, right there.
Rupert Sheldrake says that there's no way we're ever going to find biology by physical means alone. He proposes things like morphogenetic biological fields and this sort of thing. But he also points out that there are species with unique instincts, and it's very difficult to figure out where they came from. Bombardier beetle, the cuckoo bird, and the skunk have instincts that don't belong to any other creature. Is there even a remote chance, in your opinion, that some of these orphan genes are coding for not for protein sequences, but for other things like...
I think it's entirely possible. And the problem with looking for function is it's a lot more laborious than running the algorithms that Deborah described. You've actually got to isolate proteins, characterize them, and so forth. But I'm encouraged that in those cases where labs have done this, the orphans that they've examined turned out to have really surprising and interesting roles. So, for instance, an example, social behavior in bees appears to be associated with orphans. So that would be a case along the lines you describe, where you have a higher level property, eusociality in bees, that seems to be underlain by specific orphans in that group. If you're interested, I can send you the reference. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part of your question. I think so. I mean, well, let me put it this way. I don't think we have adequate models within cell biology or even organismal biology for new genes that are producing proteins just showing up on the scene and that protein expecting to have a job. It's going to be sloshing around in the cytoplasm, and it needs, you know, organisms go to great lengths to make sure everybody's got a job, and I mean, to use that colloquial language. And you don't want things aggregating on their own. Well, frankly, we do have models for the willy-nilly production of proteins. Cancer, where whole sections of genomes are transcribed in inappropriate places in tissues where they aren't supposed to be expressed, and we know what the result of that is. So I really do think we need better theories to account for these data. Let me say, by the way, one important qualification. Nothing I said in my talk directly implicated intelligent design. So for Doolittle, some of these other people that I've cited, they're all firmly within the fold of naturalistic evolution. And I want to be careful in making that point, because I think to make a case for design from these data would take a whole lot more work. I think it's suggestive, but nothing I've said directly implicates intelligent design. This is a puzzle within evolutionary theory.
Hey.
Hi, Josh.
One of the things that I keep thinking of as a discussion is that there has been work on the transcriptome and looking at what actually gets transcribed out of the genome. And there's a bunch of stuff that's not even necessarily from an open reading frame that gets transcribed and then swallowed to carry RNA. So it's the idea that these open reading frames have to come de novo and have to instantly have function, or you just have proteins floating around, seems problematic.
But I think, as you just pointed out, the regulatory systems that are monitoring those transcripts without, unemployed transcripts, so to speak, they're not going into ribosomes and being turned into polypeptides. They're being intercepted before they reach that stage. Look, transcription is sloppy. There could be a lot of stuff being transcribed that's not, you know, doesn't have a job, but it does seem to be the case that you are not taking those mRNAs all the way through to a polypeptide.
Right, but it's one thing to say that something is open reading frames with no other open reading frames that are also known functional. And it's another thing to say that it's actually a gene, but it could be that same sequence occurs elsewhere in the genome as non-coding DNA or something else, that one mutation creates an open codon or a stop codon, and all of a sudden you're off the races.
Yeah.
So it's, you shouldn't assume that each of these orphans is a functional protein producing.
You're right. And in fact, one of the...
And I don't know what fraction of the problem you're describing that addresses, but some fraction, I'm not sure.
Yeah. This actually came up when orphans and Homo sapiens were were examined. This is a paper from the PNAS in 2007, Eric Lander's lab. And they looked at about 1,200 apparent open reading frames, which is a fairly sizable fraction for a genome that's bouncing around with about 20,000, 21,000 protein coding sequences. And they made a very interesting argument why these could not be real genes. They said from the point of divergence with the chimp, so 5 to 7 million years ago, it is impossible that many novel Homo sapiens sequences could have arisen and been fixed in our lineage. And they, there was other parts of their argument. They said they didn't have ESTs for these and it looked like they weren't being expressed and so forth. But if these unique sequences are being expressed at very low level, you might not have an EST for them. In any case, the argument devolved to an evolutionary presupposition that there could not be that much unique genetic information in our lineage that's not present in the chimp. That's worrisome to me. What you ought to do is query those orphans and say, might you have a very special job that I'm not likely to see unless I see you being expressed in some particular tissue and so forth. So while I take your caveat, to heart, I do think you can err on the other side and dump things into the junk bin that are in fact functional, and you might be missing something very important. That's a very big fraction of our genome, 1,200 sequences. Anyway, this paper is now open access, and if any of you are interested in possible role of orphans in Homo sapiens, I would encourage you to take a look at it. Thank you.
Thank you all for your attention. You're all dismissed, and hope you enjoy the dinner and the rest of the conference. Thank you.
Yeah, happy to.